It's time for Radio Freethinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week, we start off on a bit of a down note as we remember the Orlando Massacre. It is something that has left its mark and has a personal connection that I don't want to get into too much, but as a person of privilege, I have to forget that privilege. I mean, being white, being male, the gift of the accident of my birth parents. But that's not universal. Orlando reminded me that I, too, can be singled out and killed if for no other reason than the way I was born. But enough about me. There's been a lot of debate about what the issue should be coming out of this hate crime. Is it an LGBTQ question? Was it a Latino slash immigrant issue? Was it a Muslim slash immigrant issue? And let's not forget ISIS, gun control, and Donald feckin' Trump. Way to ruin a good first name, guy. Well, out of all the commentary that I've heard, there's one that sort of stood out. It made me think. It made me cry. This one is from John Green, and I think it was the most fitting, and I'd like to share it with you. So let's listen in.
Good morning, Hank. It's Tuesday. I don't really want to make a video today, but it's Tuesday, so. Hank, when we were growing up in Orlando, Florida, it always felt to me like we were all just visiting, like we were all just there for the theme parks, whether to visit them or work in them. And even today, when people ask me where I'm from, I usually say Alabama, even though I didn't move there until I was 14. For a long time, I believed that because I never felt fully at home in Orlando, that no one else could either. But of course, that's just narcissism. In the 24 years since I've left, Orlando has become a great city. People have made it an awesome hometown by growing deep roots there, including a strong Latino community and a vibrant LGBT community, both of which have achieved so much with love and activism in the face of a long history of violence and discrimination. And now, 49 people killed in a gay club in Orlando. I don't know, Hank. I don't know what to say. I don't know if I have anything constructive to say. I do think it's valuable to listen to people who've been directly affected by the shootings in Orlando. I've put some reading in the doobly-doo. I was particularly moved by the partner of Leroy Valentin Fernandez, who wrote, "You will always be my baby, and I will always love you." And by the brother of victim Amanda Alvear, who said she wouldn't want anyone to spread hate for her. She would want them to spread more love. And by victim Luis Wilson Leon's friend Daniel, who said he'd been dealing with hate all his life. We all have. I have. He never retaliated with hate. Aside from that, Hank, I really just want to share with you the names of the people who were murdered. I think we should hear their names as much as possible. Last night, Orlando showed what a great city it is when thousands of people came out to memorialize the dead and to stand with their friends and families. Let us also stand with them by listening to them, by listening to those who loved them, and by remembering them. Edward Sotomayor, Jr. Stanley Omodovar, III. Luis Omar Ocasio-Capo. Eric Ivan Ortiz Rivera, Peter Ami, Juan Ramon Guerrero, Luis Vielma, Kimberly Morris, Eddie Justice, Daryl Roman Burt II, Dianca Deidre Drayton, Alejandro Barrios Martinez, Anthony Luis Loriano Disla, Jean Carlos Mendez Perez, Frankie Jimmy De Jesus Velasquez, Amanda Alvear, Martin Benitez Torres, Luis Daniel Wilson Leon, Mercedes Marisol Flores, Javier Emmanuel Serrano Rosado, Gilberto Ramon Silva Menendez, Simone Adrian Carrillo Fernandez, Oscar Aracena Montero, Enrique Rios Jr., Miguel Angel Honorato, Javier Jorge Reyes, Joel Rayon Paniagua, Jason Benjamin Josephat, Corey James Connell, Juan Rivera Velasquez, Luis Daniel Conde, Shane Evan Tomlinson, Juan Chavez Martinez, Gerald Arthur Wright, Tevin Eugene Crosby, Leroy Valentin Fernandez, Jonathan Antonio Camoy Vega, Jean Nives Rodriguez, Rodolfo Ayala Ayala, Brenda Lee Marquez McCool, Akira Monet Murray. Yumari Rodriguez Sullivan, Christopher Andrew Linonen, Angel Candelario Padro, Frank Hernandez, Paul Terrell Henry, Antonio Devon Brown, Christopher Joseph Sanfelice.
That was very touching. And the best way to fight hate is with science. So here's a clip from DNews about gay animals. And yes, you can take that both ways.
Howdy friends, Trace here for DNews with a special guest, Natalia Reagan. She is an anthropologist and a primatologist, and she's awesome.
Hey guys, there's currently a great debate raging across the United States about a law in Indiana which allegedly allows businesses to discriminate based on religious freedoms, ironically called the Religious Freedom Act, sparking outrage from the LGBT community as they are clear targets of this legislation.
Discrimination and prejudice has evolutionary roots, but then again, so does homosexuality. Research done in the 90s and early 2000s looked at sheep's sexual orientation, as they are some of the gayest animals in the animal kingdom. As many as 1 in 10 rams can be gay and will live exclusively gay lives with only male partners, even with fertile females around. The researchers believe they found a biological underpinning for homosexuality by studying these rams' hypothalamuses. Gay rams' hypothalami maybe was biologically different than straight rams. Baba, they were born this way.
You know it. It's not just sheep. More than 450 vertebrates and more than 1,500 species overall engage in homosexual acts aplenty, illustrating that homosexuality isn't against nature. It's completely part of nature.
Beetles, birds, bonobos, bats,
dolphins, orangutans, macaques, and penguins.
Dragonflies, albatross, dogs and cats, even lions all exhibit homosexual behavior.
Yep, that mighty king of the jungle ain't afraid to engage in a little spooning, sporking, and even forking of the same sex.
But why? Why would nature evolve something that seems counter to evolution?
Right? If the origin of species is correct and we're all here to achieve reproductive success, allowing us to spread our genes far and wide, then why would organisms evolve not to do that? Science is still working on it.
There are a number of theories, though. Female Japanese macaques were observed mounting each other even when suitable males are around, and they hypothesize it may be a way to climb the social ladder by becoming a dominant female in a social group and thus gaining influence and resources.
Though other researchers claim that homosexual behavior could come down to something as simple as seeking pleasure. These animals are just doing what feels good. Research with giraffes found 1 in 20 would be necking with a member of the same sex at any given moment, while bonobos and dolphins are generally bisexual, but will go through phases of exclusive homosexual activity.
They gotta give it the old college try, right? But it's not just for show. Some animals sustain lifelong homosexual relationships, like penguins. Researchers from the University of Minnesota found permanently pair-bonded female-female couples raise chicks nearly as well as female-male couples. Not quite as well, but better than a single female penguin would have done. This indicates to those researchers that homosexual pair bonds may have evolved as a way to better raise young. They can even raise chicks that were fertilized by a dominant male that was separate from the pair bond without having to pair bond with that male. Benefits all around.
Totally. Roy and Silo, two male chinstrap penguins that once lived at the Central Park Zoo, had a long-term love affair that included an adoption of a chick. The two remained together for 6 years until Silo found his eyes were wandering to a newly introduced female named Scrappy.
So just because Roy shtupped Silo yesterday doesn't mean he can't get down with Scrappy today too, right?
Right?
Cool.
Yeah, if these animals can teach us something, it's that sexuality is not static or fixed, but fluid and flexible.
And on that note, we're gonna take a little bit of an early break just to let things chill a bit. But we will be right back.
UBC SOS, also known as Students Offering Support, offers exam aid tutorial sessions to all UBC students. All proceeds go towards funding development projects in Latin American countries. Find out when our next tutorial sessions are at ubcsos.com or check out our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/ubcsos.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR 101.9 FM, your safe place in the world of woo and wackiness. And we're back. Shifting gears a little, well, a lot, this next bit of web wisdom is about the importance of ritual in our lives and how with all the advances of the modern world, we've lost something important in the act of ritual. Let's listen in.
One of the things that most strongly differentiates modern from traditional societies is the business of rituals. Broadly speaking, modern ones have very few of them. Traditional ones have a lot of them. What is a ritual? It's a periodic invitation by your society, typically by its religion, to come together with other people for an event that marks an occasion, often of an underlying spiritual or psychological nature. Perhaps it's the start of the year, the birthday of a god, a day to apologize, or a moment to feel grateful for springtime, or the love of now-dead relatives. And so you dance, say some rather formal words, eat an unusual food, or wear special clothes. And by doing all this, you are somehow helped, purged in some way, helped to grow, transition to a new stage, reconnect to an important idea, or guided to inner peace. What marks out modern societies is how ruthlessly they've stripped back rituals, largely because they get in the way of making money. To generalize, when societies become modern, rituals drop out of the calendar, and the main focus starts to be private and work life, and not much in between. A key part of understanding our own times is therefore to grasp the history of rituals, what they have been, where they've gone, and in what ways we might be missing them today. Rome, 17th of December, 150 AD. It's the first day of a three-day celebration known as the Saturnalia, a ritual festival in honor of Saturn, Roman god of wealth and agriculture. The Saturnalia is a time of ecstatic release and exuberance. The Roman poet Catullus describes the occasion as the best of times. All the normal social codes and rules are temporarily put on hold or turned upside down. Masters are expected to look after their slaves, and parents to obey their children. Slaves can even insult and poke fun at their masters with complete impunity. Important magistrates and public officials wear colourful, sometimes silly clothes and cones on their heads. You're meant to shout "Io Saturnalia" at strangers when you pass them in the street. Married couples can have affairs, and no one is meant to be unduly upset. Women can make the first move on men or sleep with one another. There are orgies and you can gamble and drink as much as you like. Then, after 3 days of fun, everything comes to a stern halt and order is restored, but life feels a lot less bitter and oppressive. The slave is back to his dinner duties, but the memory of having called his master a shit lightens his burdens. The mistress of the house is back to putting up with her boorish husband, but the 2 nights with her hairdresser make his sarcasm and dullness importantly, more bearable. Across Rome, a great many people can't wait for the 17th of December to roll around again. Alexandria, Egypt, 10th day of Tishrei, 969 AD. It's shortly after the beginning of the Jewish New Year, in one of the thriving centers of Jewish life, under the protection of benevolent Arab rule. The Day of Atonement, or Yom Kippur, is a solemn and critical event in the Hebrew calendar. Leviticus instructs that on this date, all Jews must set aside their usual family and commercial activities and mentally review their actions over the preceding year, identifying all those whom they've hurt or behaved unjustly towards. The ritual festival is kicked off by the blowing of a shofar, a hollowed-out ram's horn. Then, together in a synagogue, the Jewish community repeat in prayer, "We have sinned, we have acted treacherously." They then seek out those whom they've frustrated, angered, discarded casually, or otherwise betrayed, and offer them their fullest contrition. This is God's will, and a rare opportunity for blanket forgiveness. "All the people are in fault," says the prayer, "and so may all the people of Israel be forgiven, including all the strangers who live in their midst." The Day of Atonement has the immense advantage of making the idea of saying sorry look like it came from somewhere else, neither the idea of the perpetrator nor of the victim. Under the assumed eye of a benevolent God, it allows everyone a chance to make a clean break and move on. Medina, June 1210 AD. It's the start of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, marking the first revelation of the Quran to Muhammad. As one of the five pillars of Islam, fasting is obligatory for virtually all Muslims, requiring abstinence from sex as well as smoking, swearing, and violence. Fasting is believed to cleanse the soul by removing from it worldly concerns and focusing on God alone. It's admired as a way to teach self-discipline, self-control, and empathy for those less fortunate. Adherence to Ramadan will provide strength and spiritual growth for the upcoming year. Ramadan gives vital encouragement to an enduring human desire, the wish to start afresh, reform oneself, and lead a better life henceforth. But rather than these ambitions being left to the individual alone, Islam wisely creates a collective moment to strengthen the will, and it finds a fitting physical activity to support what is at heart a spiritual endeavor. Gazelle Peninsula, Papua New Guinea, 1652. A mother has come to visit her adult daughter and grandchildren for a few weeks in a village community of the Baining tribe. Now it's time to say farewell. There is sadness all around, and the mother and her guide head off through thickly forested hills. It may be a long time till mother and daughter will see each other again. The Baining have developed a special word to describe the feeling that can come over you when a friend or relative you love has left. They call it Awambuk. Symptoms of Awambuk include sleeping in, losing a sense of purpose, and an inclination to burst into tears. But the Baining have also developed an accompanying ritual to deal with the sadness of Awambuk. The people who've been left are granted 3 days, during which they're not expected to do any gardening or hunting. Everyone is supposed to behave very gently around them. Then, on the third day, the sufferers have to leave a coconut shell of water on the veranda of their house. It's believed to soak up sadness, and with a few ritual words, they then throw the water out into the garden, thereby purging their emotions and signalling a return to active life. The ritual of Awambuk is similar to mourning rituals all over the world. It legitimates what might otherwise be a guilty or confused melancholy. It gives sadness a shape and a direction. It demarcates a time for it, and then gently creates a moment when we're meant to overcome it and rejoin the group. Warsaw, Poland, Spring 1798. It's the Jewish festival of Birkat Ilanot, which dictates that at the time of the first blossom, the community will gather outdoors by some trees and flowers in bloom to appreciate the beauty of nature and honour the generosity of its creator. In the company of a rabbi, Jews recite a ritual prayer from the Talmud, honouring the hand that made the blossom. Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who didn't leave a single thing lacking in his world, filling it with the finest creatures and trees, so as to give pleasure to all of mankind. 2,000 kilometres to the west, an English poet is also struck by the beauty of spring, and wants to express his enthusiasm and gratitude. I heard 1,000 blended notes, while in a grove I sat reclined, writes William Wordsworth in the opening stanza of his Lines Written in Early Spring of 1798. Both the Jewish community and the poet appreciate springtime, but the poet is not interested in ritualizing his feelings. He is emblematic of a new age known as Romanticism, which believes in leaving people to feel things at their own pace, at a time of their choosing. Religious belief is in decline across Europe, and for many, rituals are tainted by being associated with the supernatural. That's unfortunate. Even in the hands of religions, rituals have been guardians of very important states of mind that would otherwise be crushed or neglected. A book of poetry is in the end a hushed object in a noisy world, whereas a ritual protects emotions to which we are sincerely inclined, but which, without a degree of fabrication and structure, we might be too distracted and undisciplined to make time for. London, October 1834. James Patterson, the governor of the Bank of England, cuts annual national or so-called bank holidays to just 4 a year. Only 3 years earlier, the English bank, like many English businesses, had been closed for 36 days a year to make room for all sorts of traditional ritual festivals up and down the land. The bank's drive to slash holidays is typical of a 100-year-long process that begins in the late 18th century. The Industrial Revolution has made it deeply inconvenient for employers to let their workers take holidays to mark this or that ritual. The collective purification of the soul is of no interest to employers. It's something you can do in your own time. There are even suggestions to put an end to Christmas and Easter, which together cost industry a fortune. Nuremberg, Germany, 30th of August 1933. Adolf Hitler leads the Rally of Victory. 700,000 people are in attendance. People sing martial songs. Wagner blasts from speakers. There are banners of swastikas, torchlight parades, and thousands of soldiers goose-stepping. To engender a sense of fraternity, flags are ritualistically touched against a blood-soaked flag from Hitler's beer hall putsch of November 1923. Hitler speaks for hours on racial supremacy, German art and architecture, and an international Jewish conspiracy threatening to bring down the Aryan race. Behavior like this hastens the modern suspicion of any ritual behavior. Collective activity and excitement start to seem ever more eerie, mob-like, and out of sync with an individualistic age. London, 30th of July, 1966. 96,000 people, including the Queen of England, take their seats inside Wembley Stadium to watch England defeat West Germany in the World Cup final. 32 million people are watching on TV. The picture of England captain Bobby Moore hoisting the trophy is immortalised by a statue in East London, while the ball is canonised in a special museum in Manchester. Rituals have continued into the modern age, but they now tend to be around sport. They're very limited in their ambitions and lack a lot of the psychological richness of religious-minded rituals of old. Australia, 26th of May 2015. The 18th annual Sorry Day is held in Australia when white Australians atone for the removal of 50,000 children from Aboriginal tribes. The day is a sombre occasion for reflection, with speeches from the Indigenous Australian community and politicians of all stripes. However, the day meets with little public enthusiasm and engenders little change. No compensation is awarded, and many feel the day obscures the still prevalent kidnapping of children from Aboriginal families. Like so many modern rituals, even ones emphasising important events in a nation's identity, National Sorry Day feels rather placid and in many ways token. The part of human nature that craved and created rituals has not been eliminated, but it is currently in many developed societies quiescent or unfairly tainted by associations with the less admirable sides of religion. So a lot of what we used to do in ritual ways, we now do privately. We have moments of carnivalesque indulgence, we get drunk, have affairs, say sorry, purge ourselves, and feel grateful for existence. But we also do so without guidance, and therefore our behaviour often lacks boundaries, or is half-hearted or colourless. We also often just forget things. We have very few collective appointments with important emotions, but perhaps we remain in need of rituals all the same, points in the calendar that help us in our endeavours to be sane and kind. A challenge for the future will be to create new rituals, every bit as convincing as those of old, with the proper resources of art, music and design, that will take some of the burdens off us as individuals. We'll have realised that being modern has not replaced our need for rituals.
Well, it is a ritual here on Radio Free Thinker to expand our understanding of the world. And how do we understand the world? Via the words we use. But there is a danger in words. And here's a talk about what Aurelian really means. Let's listen and learn.
If you've watched the news or followed politics, chances are you've heard the term Aurelian thrown around in one context or another. But have you ever stopped to think about what it really means or why it's used so often? The term was named after British author Eric Blair, known by his pen name, George Orwell. Because his most famous work, the novel 1984, depicts an oppressive society under a totalitarian government, Orwellian is often used simply to mean authoritarian. But using the term in this way not only fails to fully convey Orwell's message, it actually risks doing precisely what he tried to warn against. Orwell was indeed opposed to all forms of tyranny, spending much of his life fighting against anti-democratic forces of both the left wing and the right. But he was also deeply concerned with how such ideologies proliferate. And one of his most profound insights was the importance that language plays in shaping our thoughts and opinions. The government of 1984's Oceania controls its people's actions and speech in some ways that are obvious. Their every move and word is watched and heard. And the threat of what happens to those who step out of line is always looming overhead. Other forms of control are not so obvious. The population is inundated with a constant barrage of propaganda, made up of historical facts and statistics manufactured in the Ministry of Truth. The Ministry of Peace is the military. Labor camps are called joy camps. Political prisoners are detained and tortured in the Ministry of Love. This deliberate irony is an example of doublespeak, when words are used not to convey meaning, but to undermine it, corrupting the very ideas they refer to. The regime's control of language goes even further, eliminating words from the English language to create the official dialect of Newspeak, a crudely limited collection of acronyms and simple concrete nouns, lacking any words complex enough to encourage nuanced or critical thought. This has an effect on the psyche Orwell calls doublethink, a hypnotic state of cognitive dissonance in which one is compelled to disregard their own perception in place of the officially dictated version of events, leaving the individual completely dependent on the state's definition of reality itself. The result is a world in which even the privacy of one's own thought process is violated, where one may be found guilty of thought crime by talking in their sleep. And keeping a diary or having a love affair equals a subversive act of rebellion. This might sound like something that can only happen in totalitarian regimes. But Orwell was warning us about the potential for this occurring even in democratic societies. And this is why authoritarian alone does not Orwellian make. In his essay Politics and the English Language, he described techniques like using pretentious words to project authority, or making atrocities sound acceptable by burying them in euphemisms and convoluted sentence structures. But even more mundane abuses of language can affect the way we think about things. The words you see and hear in everyday advertising have been crafted to appeal to you and affect your behavior, as have the soundbites and talking points of political campaigns, which rarely present the most nuanced perspective on the issues. And the way that we use ready-made phrases and responses, gleaned from media reports or copied from the internet, makes it easy to get away with not thinking too deeply or questioning your assumptions. So the next time you hear someone use the word Orwellian, pay close attention. If they're talking about the deceptive and manipulative use of language, they're on the right track. If they're talking about mass surveillance and intrusive government, they're describing something authoritarian, but not necessarily Orwellian. And if they use it as an all-purpose word for any ideas they dislike, it's possible their statements are more Orwellian than whatever it is they're criticizing. Words have the power to shape thought. Language is the currency of politics, forming the basis of society from the most common everyday interactions to the highest ideals. Orwell urged us to protect our language, because ultimately, our ability to think and communicate clearly is what stands between us and a world where war is peace and freedom is slavery.
And if that wasn't confusing enough, let's follow that with a labyrinthine bureaucracy and discover what makes something Kafkaesque.
Someone must have been telling lies about Joseph K. He knew he had done nothing wrong, but one morning, he was arrested. Thus begins The Trial, one of author Franz Kafka's most well-known novels. K, the protagonist, is arrested out of nowhere and made to go through a bewildering process where neither the cause of his arrest nor the nature of the judicial proceedings are made clear to him. This sort of scenario is considered so characteristic of Kafka's work that scholars came up with a new word for it. Kafkaesque has entered the vernacular to describe unnecessarily complicated and frustrating experiences, like being forced to navigate labyrinths of bureaucracy. But does standing in a long line to fill out confusing paperwork really capture the richness of Kafka's vision? Beyond the word's casual use, what makes something Kafkaesque? Franz Kafka's stories do indeed deal with many mundane and absurd aspects of modern bureaucracy, drawn in part from his experience of working as an insurance clerk in early 20th century Prague. Many of his protagonists are office workers compelled to struggle through a web of obstacles in order to achieve their goals. And often the whole ordeal turns out to be so disorienting and illogical that success becomes pointless in the first place. For example, in the short story Poseidon, the ancient Greek god, is an executive so swamped with paperwork that he's never had time to explore his underwater domain. The joke here is that not even a god can handle the amount of paperwork demanded by the modern workplace. But the reason why is telling. He's unwilling to delegate any of the work because he deems everyone else unworthy of the task. Kafka's Poseidon is a prisoner of his own ego. This simple story contains all of the elements that make for a truly Kafkaesque scenario. It's not the absurdity of bureaucracy alone, but the irony of the character's circular reasoning in reaction to it that is emblematic of Kafka's writing. His tragicomic stories act as a form of mythology for the modern industrial age, employing dream logic to explore the relationships between systems of arbitrary power and the individuals caught up in them. Take, for example, Kafka's most famous story, Metamorphosis. When Gregor Samsa awakens one morning to find himself transformed into a giant insect, his greatest worry is that he gets to work on time. Of course, this proves impossible. It was not only the authoritarian realm of the workplace that inspired Kafka. Some of his protagonist's struggles come from within. The short story A Hunger Artist describes a circus performer whose act consists of extended fasts. He's upset that the circus master limits these to 40 days, believing this prevents him from achieving greatness in his art. But when his act loses popularity, he is left free to starve himself to death. The twist comes when he lays dying in anonymity, regretfully admitting that his art has always been a fraud. He fasted not through strength of will, but simply because he never found a food he liked. Even in the trial, which seems to focus directly on bureaucracy, the vague laws and bewildering procedures point to something far more sinister. The terrible momentum of the legal system proves unstoppable, even by supposedly powerful officials. This is a system that doesn't serve justice, but whose sole function is to perpetuate itself. What political theorist Hannah Arendt, writing years after Kafka's death, would call tyranny without a tyrant. Yet, accompanying the bleakness of Kafka's stories, there's a great deal of humor, rooted in the nonsensical logic of the situations described. So on the one hand, it's easy to recognize the Kafkaesque in today's world. We rely on increasingly convoluted systems of administration that have real consequences on every aspect of our lives. And we find our every word judged by people we can't see according to rules we don't know. On the other hand, by fine-tuning our attention to the absurd, Kafka also reflects our shortcomings back at ourselves. In doing so, he reminds us that the world we live in is one we create and have the power to change for the better.
And on that confusing note, we're going to pause for a little break.
You have hair? Do you want to help children in need? The UBC Cancer Association has an event for you. Custer Cancer provides visitors with professional haircuts, with all proceeds going to the Canadian Cancer Society. With a donation of over 8 inches, the haircut is free. Hair donations are made into wigs for patients at the BC Children's Hospital. Last year, we raised over $65,000, but this year, we hope to break $100,000. Help make our dreams possible this February. Check out the UBC Cancer Association Facebook page for more details.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR 101.9 FM. Your double plus good skeptical radio broadcast from Vancouver, Canada. And we're back. Like a fine sports car, we're going to shift gears again and focus on science, more specifically chemistry. More specifically, again, five chemicals that you'll find in almost everything you eat. Bon appetit.
If you live in a place with lots of people, decent internet, and maybe a 7-Eleven within walking distance, then you're probably used to getting your food in certain familiar form. Fewer and fewer of us these days get our sustenance in ways that most of us would consider natural, right off the branch or off the bone. Instead, especially in industrialized countries, a lot of our food is processed, far away from where we actually eat it. So we've had to devise all kinds of clever ways to make our food taste the way it's supposed to taste, and look the way we expect it to look, and generally survive the journey to our tables intact. For about 150 years, the science of food chemistry has given us things like strawberry candy that's the color of strawberries, and soy-based burger substitutes that look and taste like meat instead of the mashed-up edamame that they basically are. Plus, food chemistry has given us many different ways to preserve foods, protecting us from the toxic fungi and bacteria that try to get to our meals before we do. Chemists accomplish all of these feats with the use of additives, substances that are used to affect any number of food's characteristics, from their color, to their purity, to their mouthfeel. You've probably seen these additives listed on nutrition labels. Some additives are completely synthetic, made by chemists from scratch, while others occur naturally, though you might be surprised by how they're grown and harvested. And maybe you're wary of having some of these compounds in your food, which is understandable since none of us really knows what this means. But for whatever it's worth to you, all of the 3,000 plus additives found in food in the U.S. are listed by the Food and Drug Administration as GRAS, or generally recognized as safe. Now, the most common kinds of additives, artificial flavorings, are really their own branch of food science. In order to answer questions like why there's really no such thing as nacho cheese, or why grape-flavored stuff never actually tastes like grapes, we'd have to get into the chemistry of taste, how the chemical receptors in your nose and mouth work, and how we can fool them. But let's save that for another time. For now, a lot of how food tastes is informed by how it looks. So let's start with the most widely used food coloring in the world, red dye number 40, known in Europe as E129. People in the food industry like to refer to this particular compound as Allura Red, which makes it sound like some kind of sexy nail polish, but considering that this is its full chemical name, I can't say that I blame them. Red dye number 40 is actually made from petroleum, and it's a kind of synthetic azo dye, a compound that contains azo bonds, double bonds that form between two atoms of nitrogen. These bonds give the molecule a particular shape that reflects light from the orange to red part of the spectrum. But you might be thinking, there's a lot of food that's naturally red, like red cabbage and beets, so why not just use whatever makes those things red and put that in your strawberry candy? Well, those foods get their color from compounds called carotenoids, and they are sometimes used as food coloring. But carotenoids have a totally different structure than azo dyes do. They're basically long chains of carbon and hydrogen, and they break down pretty easily, especially when exposed to light and oxygen. So many food chemists use red dye number 40 because it's not only cheaper to make from scratch than it is to extract carotenoids from other food, but the color also lasts longer on the shelf. Now, whether your food looks like what it tastes like is one thing, but what about how it feels? The consistency of food is important. People don't usually want to eat cheese that's runny or chew on jerky that's hard as a rock, but consistency is one of the harder qualities of food to control. That's because the components of food products can often separate, like in salad dressings or sauces. And at other times, manufacturers want to avoid using certain ingredients like animal fat or egg yolk, usually to save some calories. So they need something to put in place of those ingredients to help hold the food together. And that is where stabilizers come in. Stabilizers are compounds that chemically imitate fats, carbohydrates, or proteins to create homogeneous mixtures of ingredients that otherwise wouldn't stay mixed. It's thanks to stabilizers that veggie burgers feel like hamburgers when you eat them, and why pasta sauces pour out of the jar as a single liquid instead of separate globs of oils, water, and vegetable puree. And two of the most common stabilizers are naturally occurring, though they're not from the sources that you might expect. Xanthan gum might sound like something you'd chew during algebra class, but it's not what the name suggests. Chewing gum, like other true gums, is derived from plants. But xanthan gum is produced by bacteria, which release it as a waste product during fermentation. Manufacturers basically farm the stuff by keeping a bunch of bacteria known as Xanthomonas campestris in an oxygen-free environment. As the germs respire, they secrete long, complex sugars called polysaccharides, which are then mixed with rubbing alcohol to get rid of the other waste. Then they're dried and ground into a fine powder. This powdered starch is great at stabilizing food because it easily adsorbs water. Molecules of xanthan gum attract molecules of water, which bind to it, creating a thick, gel-like substance. And this gooey medium is perfect for enhancing what food scientists call mouthfeel. So if you're making a burger out of soybeans or a salad dressing without oil, xanthan gum will fill in the spots where the fat used to be, so your food feels like what your mouth is expecting. But hey, maybe you're not so keen on bacterial excrement. Maybe you'd prefer seaweed. Another one of the most commonly used stabilizers in food is carrageenan, which is basically just ground up red seaweed, a type of algae. Like xanthan gum, carrageenan is a long, complex polysaccharide, and its curvy helical structure makes it particularly good at binding not only with water, but also with proteins. This makes carrageenan a useful fat replacer in foods like ice creams, soy and almond milk, fake meats, and other foods where proteins make up the bulk of the dish. And it, too, is farmed on an industrial scale. Manufacturers just grow giant pools of red algae where they wash, boil, and dry it until all that's left is the carrageenan starch, which is ground into flour. So not all food additives are synthetic, and this is also true for some of the most common preservatives, the chemicals that keep microbes and fungi from causing food to decay. For example, one of the most widely used preservatives is citric acid, the same stuff that makes lemons sour and oranges tangy. Citric acid is used to keep fruits from turning brown and canned foods from tasting canny, for the very same reason that it has a tart taste, its acidity. In fruits and vegetables, citric acid blocks the natural enzymes found in plant tissues that cause them to spoil. The enzyme phenolase, for example, is what makes a slice of apple turn brown. Phenolase uses oxygen in the air to create a browned pigment called melanin, which serves as sort of a protective coating over the apple's damaged tissue. But citric acid lowers the pH in that tissue, which makes the enzyme unable to function. And when phenolase is prevented from making a brown mush, fruits and vegetables can stay fresh longer, even if they've been sliced or if they get damaged during shipping. Citric acid also has the extra benefit of bonding easily with free-floating ions of metal, so it and other acids are often added to canned foods. That way, any stray atoms of metal from the can will bind to the citric acid and not to the food inside, a process known as chelation. So since citric acid occurs in lemons, oranges, and anything else citrusy, making it must be easy. Just squeeze a bunch of fruit and ship it out to the old food factory. Except, not really. The fact is, there are literally not enough lemons and limes in the world to produce all of the citric acid that food manufacturers need. And extracting the acid from fruit is actually really complicated and expensive. So citric acid is mass-produced much like xanthan gum and carrageenan are, but instead of being pooped out by bacteria or mulched out of seaweed, it's excreted by mold. A black fungus known as aspergillus, which ironically enough is the same stuff that grows on spoiled food, produces citric acid when it metabolizes sugar in a low oxygen environment. So food companies just spread out a bunch of the fungus on a bed of molasses and let it ferment. As the mold metabolizes the sugar, the citric acid is captured and dried into a powder. But the chemistry is a little bit different when it comes to what's probably the world's most commonly used preservative. Sodium benzoate. The active ingredient here is really benzoic acid, a naturally occurring acid that's found in things like plums and cranberries. In large enough amounts, benzoic acid can kill fungi like yeasts and many kinds of bacteria by blocking the enzymes that they need to survive. So it's really handy for preserving foods that are already a little bit acidic on their own, like sauces, dressings, juices, jellies, and condiments. But benzoic acid doesn't dissolve in water, so food chemists have to stash it inside something that does. So they make a salt of benzoic acid by reacting it with sodium hydroxide, also known as lye or caustic soda, to make sodium benzoate. Now, that's not something that occurs naturally, and some consumers are very wary of sodium benzoate and other compounds like it for that reason. There's no denying that additives can have their downsides. Sodium benzoate, for example, has been found to react with ascorbic acid, also known as vitamin C, to produce benzene, a hydrocarbon that's known to cause cancer. In a random sampling of 200 kinds of soft drinks sold around the U.S. from 2005 to 2006, the Food and Drug Administration found that 9 of the soft drink brands contained levels of benzene that were above the federal safety threshold of 5 parts per billion. It's worth noting that all of these drinks have since been reformulated. But some naturally occurring compounds have been restricted too. The FDA has warned against using some baby food supplements that contain xanthan gum, for instance, because it might lead to potentially dangerous clumping in babies' intestines. As for red dye number 40, it's been used in the U.S. for more than 40 years, but it's banned in 4 European countries because some studies suggest that there's a link between the dye and hyperactivity in children, a link that the EU and FDA haven't established in their own research. So, if you live in a world where your food looks like this, then odds are there's seaweed in your soy milk and petroleum byproducts in your candy. Thanks to food chemistry, your eyes, mouth, and stomach will never know the difference.
And from the chemicals you eat to the chemicals you make, you crafty pharmacy, you, let's listen in.
Everything is chemicals. Your brain, your skin, your blood, your organs, your entire body is made of chemicals. Some you might have heard of before, like the neurotransmitter dopamine, which helps you feel happiness and motivation, among other things. Others don't get talked about as much, like alpha-ketoglutarate, which helps you make energy. And every day, your body produces some chemicals that you might find surprising, ones you'd usually think of as poisons, or workout supplements, psychedelic drugs, or even embalming fluid. They might sound strange or even harmful, but they're an important part of how your body works, and in some cases, we probably wouldn't even survive without them. First up is formaldehyde, a molecule best known for preserving dead things like animals in jars or even human corpses. Formaldehyde is great at this because it locks a bunch of cellular components together in a process called fixation, which stops any chemical reactions and makes tissues more rigid. This slows down any decomposition and kills off stray bacteria. Formaldehyde solutions are so good at preserving dead bodies that funeral directors keep using it, even though it's known to cause cancer after prolonged exposure. So too much formaldehyde isn't very good for you, but your body does need a small amount of it to work properly. Your cells cells normally produce formaldehyde during some metabolic processes, where they break down molecules and build up new ones. For example, you convert formaldehyde into a compound called formate, which helps make the nucleic acids adenine and guanine, two of the four building blocks of DNA. Some gets broken down further and peed out or exhaled, but normally there are at least a couple micrograms of formaldehyde floating around in your blood. Small amounts of acetone are also naturally found in your blood and urine. You might know acetone as the active ingredient in nail polish remover and paint thinner. At high concentrations, acetone can cause skin rashes and irritation. But your body also makes acetone when you're desperately in need of energy. Usually, most of your energy comes from carbohydrates, like glucose that's in your food or stored in your cells. But when you exercise a lot, or if you're on a low-carb diet, your body starts making energy from other sources, like by breaking down fats in different ways. And when your body breaks down fats without much glucose around, it produces compounds called ketone bodies. One of those compounds is acetoacetate, which can break down further into acetone. Your body doesn't really use acetone for anything, so mostly it just tries to get rid of it. In fact, if you have too much acetone hanging around, it can make your blood acidic, which is not great. This is more of a risk for people with type 1 diabetes, who have a harder time getting glucose into their cells and rely more on the synthesis of ketone bodies for energy. Some of that acetone leaves your body when you exhale, and some people with too many ketone bodies may even have a fruity smell to their breath from breathing out so much acetone. But mostly, you just get rid of the extra acetone in your urine. Hydrochloric acid is one of the strongest acids out there. Highly concentrated solutions can dissolve some metals, and it can cause severe burns if it gets on your skin. That dangerous dissolving power is precisely why your body makes it. We eat food to get lots of different nutrients, like glucose, fats, amino acids, and vitamins. However, these simple compounds that our cells use are usually trapped in more complex molecules. Plus, a lot of bacteria tend to hitch a ride on our food since they want the nutrients too. So to break down our food and kill a lot of that bacteria, our stomachs use the power of hydrochloric acid. Stomach acid has about the same pH as battery acid, so it's plenty strong enough to break down all kinds of molecules in your food. It's also strong enough to break down the proteins in the cell walls of your stomach, and you don't exactly want your stomach eating holes in itself. So for protection, our stomach cells generate a layer of mucus that's full of bicarbonate ions, which acts as a physical barrier that neutralizes the harsh hydrochloric acid. So in some sense, your stomach is locked in a perpetual battle with itself so it can get you the energy you need to stay alive. Hypochlorous acid is weaker than hydrochloric acid, but it's still not something to play around with. Hypochlorous acid is the active ingredient in a lot of household bleaches, and it's also in a lot of disinfectants because it's so good at killing bacteria. Bacterial cell walls are often negatively charged, which means they repel any potential harmful molecules that also happen to be negatively charged. But hypochlorous acid is neutral, so it's able to slip right past the defensive wall and start messing with the proteins inside, or even start breaking down the wall itself. Since cells don't really do so well without working proteins, the bacteria die. Your body uses hypochlorous acid for the same reason. The white blood cells in your immune system protect your body by seeking out invaders like viruses and bacteria. Then they engulf the intruder and use hypochlorous acid to kill it. So when you clean off your counters at home, you're disinfecting just like your white blood cells do. Despite what you might have learned about hydrogen peroxide when you were little, you probably shouldn't be using it to clean up wounds because it kills whatever it touches, including the cells that are trying to help you stop bleeding. But whether you put it there or not, you're gonna find some hydrogen peroxide around a new cut because that cut makes your cells release it naturally. The burst of hydrogen peroxide acts like a big please send help signal, so your body sends platelets and other cells to start blocking up the wound. Plus, it sends a whole flock of white blood cells to kill any bacteria. Citric acid is responsible for that bitter taste in oranges, lemons, limes, and lots of other citrus fruits. It's also used to add tang to a lot of sodas and to make sour candies sour. Your cells make citric acid as a part of the process that turns everything you eat, carbs, proteins, and fats, into energy and carbon dioxide. The citric acid gets put into the citric acid cycle, also known as the TCA cycle or the Krebs cycle, or just that thing everybody hates memorizing for bio class. Ammonia is a base, unlike all the acids we've talked about so far. It's used as a fertilizer, and it's also in a lot of cleaning products because it's good at breaking down fats and oils. But your body also produces ammonia when it metabolizes proteins, and so do a lot of bacteria in your digestive system. Your body uses some of that ammonia in your kidneys. The ammonia bonds to hydrogen, which helps stop too much acid from building up. Your liver then turns any extra ammonia into urea, one of the main components of urine, and gets rid of it as waste. Now let's talk about drugs, specifically endocannabinoids. Cannabinoids may sound familiar because some of them are the main chemicals that interact with receptors in people's brains when they use cannabis, or pot as the kids are calling it these days. Endocannabinoids are compounds your body makes that work on those same receptors. Their main purpose seems to be reinforcing energy-storing behaviors by making them pleasurable, like eating fatty foods. The compounds are even found in the developing brains of babies and in breast milk. They probably keep babies more interested in eating and in eating more often, like a chemical appetite booster to keep them well-nourished. Endocannabinoids are nothing compared to a much more intense compound called dimethyltryptamine, or DMT. DMT has been called the most powerful hallucinogen known to man in science. Unlike everything else we've talked about, scientists aren't quite sure why your body makes such a powerful psychedelic. It's been detected in trace amounts in human blood, urine, and cerebrospinal fluid, and it's probably some kind of byproduct. It's possible that DMT is produced by our brains, and if that's the case, it might help our brains calm down. down, but the research so far has been mostly inconclusive, so nobody knows for sure. We'll wrap up today with creatine, a compound that a lot of people use as a workout supplement. Creatine is typically stored in your body as the compound phosphocreatine, which is just a phosphate group bound to a creatine molecule. Phosphocreatine makes itself useful by donating its phosphate group to create more of the ATP molecules that keep your muscles going. That's why people consume creatine as a fitness supplement. It gives you a little bit of extra energy during intense muscle activity. In your body, creatine is normally made in your liver, kidneys, and pancreas from parts of the amino acids glycine, arginine, and methionine. From there, it's distributed to your muscles through your bloodstream and converted into phosphocreatine, where it sits and waits until you need a burst of energy. Different people naturally have different levels of creatine in their systems, so people with lower levels may get more out of taking creatine supplements, but people who naturally synthesize more don't really respond very much to it. Their bodies just don't need the extra help.
And lastly, in a chemical trio, can you have too much of a good thing? Resist that next glass of water and maybe hold your breath a little as we learn that you can have too much of a good thing. Let's listen and learn.
Look at your body. It's pretty great, right? Doing all that complicated stuff to keep you alive. Well, your body runs by the grace of a delicate balance, maintaining just the right levels of the materials you need to live. Water, salts, oxygen, even your own blood cells. And you already know that getting too little of something, like water or air or a vitamin or nutrient, is, medically speaking, bad. Like, leads to death. But things that are considered healthy or beneficial or even essential can be just as dangerous in the wrong amounts. In fact, many vital substances, including some that you are taking in right now, can totally do you in if you end up ingesting just a little too much of them. So consider yourself warned. You know how important water is to your body. I mean, seeing how it accounts for more than 60% of your total body mass, you pretty much are water. And the water in your body performs a lot of important functions. But one of the most important happens when it combines with ions from dissolved minerals like sodium and potassium, which you probably know as electrolytes. Your cells use different concentrations of these electrolytes to create the positive and negative charges that regulate your internal electrical system. This is what you use to power your moving and thinking and everything else that your body does, which is why dehydration is no joke. Without enough water, the loss of electrolytes can lead to the biological version of an electrical blackout, taking power away from your vital organs, including your brain and your heart. But what you might not realize is that drinking too much water can be equally dangerous. Yeah, it turns out those urban legends about folks dying from drinking too much water aren't legends at all, and death by water intoxication is a thing. Fraternity hazing ceremonies and radio station contests that dared people to chug a bunch of water have actually ended in deaths. And so have overzealous attempts to rehydrate after running marathons or hiking in hot weather or after long drug-fueled dance parties. The condition is called hyponatremia, or insufficient salt in the blood, and it basically means you've diluted your blood too much for your electrolytes to do you any good. Chug 6 liters of water in a sitting, and your kidneys probably won't be able to flush it through fast enough to reestablish a proper balance. Instead, all that extra water starts seeking out higher concentrations of electrolytes, especially ions like sodium in your cells, which makes your cells swell up like water balloons. The lack of electrical power is a big enough problem on its own, but some of your cells just can't take on that much water. The neurons in your brain, for example, are jam-packed tight into your skull and don't have much room to expand. That's why the brain swelling, or cerebral edema, caused by too much water is so dangerous. It can lead to seizures, coma, brain damage, and death. In the end, death by dehydration and death by water intoxication have a lot of the same symptoms and the same mechanisms in common, because they're really the same before about how a lot of so-called doping in professional sports actually involves tinkering with your blood volume. But having the right amount of blood cells is also key to maintaining your body's balance. And most of the imbalances that occur here are usually caused by medical conditions. You've probably heard how a low blood cell count can be a sign of trouble, like cancer or HIV/AIDS. But more is definitely not better when it comes to blood cells. An overproduction of white blood cells, for example, is known as leukocytosis. And even though white blood cells are the white knights of your immune system, this condition actually suppresses your immune response. Leukemia is perhaps the most well-known disorder associated with excess white blood cells. It's a blood cancer that occurs when a person's bone marrow starts churning out immature and abnormal white blood cells. Unlike their healthy kin, these cells can't actually fight infection, and they don't die when they should. Instead, they keep dividing and multiplying until they crowd out healthy red blood cells and platelets. Eventually, the body winds up being unable to adequately fight infection, carry oxygen, or stop bleeding. Likewise, a mutation in bone marrow cells can cause the overproduction of red blood cells, like in the case of a different type of blood cancer called polycythemia vera. In a healthy body, red blood cells account for about 45% of the blood, but in people with conditions like polycythemia, the blood can get too thick, increasing the risk of blood clots, heart attack, and stroke. But now to oxygen. Surely that's something that you just can't get too much of, right? Yeah, no. And frankly, by now, you really shouldn't be surprised to hear it, because balance. I think we can all agree that oxygen is generally a good thing. In fact, it's probably the most important thing. You can go weeks without food, days without water if you have to, but without oxygen, you could die within minutes. The air we breathe is about 21% oxygen, and when you inhale, your red blood cells grab the O2 from your lungs and pass it off to other cells, which use it for cellular respiration, the process of breaking down sugar to create chemical energy. So without oxygen, your cells wouldn't have the energy to do anything. And yet, while they would quickly die without enough oxygen, they would die even faster with too much. So-called oxygen toxicity can happen when the body is flooded with oxygen too quickly, usually in a hospital setting, like when a person's being resuscitated from a heart attack or stroke, or when a premature baby is getting some help breathing. Basically, the risk here is from our old foe, oxidative stress. You know about the threat posed by free radicals, which run around oxidizing just about anything they can snag an electron from, but nothing oxidizes like oxygen. Oxygen itself is super needy, with two vacancies in its outer electron shell that it would just love to fill up. On its own, oxygen can go around your body creating free radicals, which go on to steal electrons from other molecules. Of course, our bodies produce antioxidants to repair the damage that all of this oxygen can cause, but we're used to dealing with the stress caused by living in a 21% oxygen environment, not 100%. And in the past decade or so, scientists have discovered that giving patients 100% oxygen creates hordes of free radicals that can cause all kinds of tissue damage. In 2008, for example, researchers in Texas found that oxygen-deprived baby mice that were treated with 100% oxygen experienced brain damage and exhibited symptoms similar to cerebral palsy. Why? Well, all that oxygen created a wave of free radicals that caused enormous oxidative stress, doing special damage to the cells that make myelin, the fatty insulation that covers nerve cells. But the researchers were able to treat some of the harmful effects by giving the mice antioxidants, of course, only in the proper amounts. So the take-home message here is that your body maintains specific balances for good reason. You live in a complex world with special, precious amounts of what you need to survive, and you are set up to take in only what you need and use only what you take. So when it comes to water or oxygen, antioxidants, or your own blood cells, you can end up having too much of a good thing.
And that's all the time we have this week. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truth.
Weary of listening to Uncle's tired old war stories? Had enough of Zuzu's quest for father's favor? Do you want to hear tales worthy of the Fire Nation princess herself? Then tune in to Scald's Hall on CITR 101.9 FM and listen to the very best established and upcoming storytellers in the land. Do it, peasant, for your princess commands you.
Join us Fridays at 9 p.m. for the very best in spoken word entertainment.
Ty Lee, you're not thinking of changing the dial, are you? That's better.